And now the real deal. Now we really get to hear Ben. It's just not a fake out. So Ben has come up to us tonight from Doylestown. Would you please help me welcome him?
Hello, my name's Ben. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I am from Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Bear with me if it's a little rough at the start. It takes a little bit for God to come in and kick in and get me going here. But it hasn't failed yet, at least since I've gone through the step work and established a relationship with God, which is really, you know, what I'm supposed to do here tonight, is just tell my experience, because you know, hopefully there's somebody here tonight that can relate to the things I'm going to talk about. But I listen to a lot of speaker tapes and I go to a lot of speaker meetings, and I always, like, I've heard my story a couple times, but it's not exactly my story. So, you know, I'll just do my best to tell you what my experience has been like. You know, while drinking and what happened and how I established a relationship with God through the process of the 12 steps. So I grew up maybe, I guess it's like 15 miles from here down in Doylestown. And I had a good family and a really good childhood. Like in hindsight, I was always looking for something or someone to blame for all of the things that happened to me throughout my drinking and even in my sobriety, before going through any kind of steps or anything like that where I was suffering. You know, selfishly, I'd always think, like, it would have been cool to have a brother pave the way before I came across my family, because really this disease took everybody around me by storm. And it completely turned the lives of my parents and my sisters and friends and even extended family. Everybody's life got turned upside down. Like it says in the book, we're like a tornado running through the lives of others. And that's totally true in my life. And when I think, you know, it's getting better, but there was a long time after, you know, I went through the step work and could really see the damage that I caused. And like I had the nerve to try to point out my upbringing for the reason that I turned out the way that I did, because I couldn't accept the fact that, like, all this was happening to me and that possibly I was responsible for it all. Like, that just didn't make any sense, and I wasn't gonna take credit for that, you know. So it had to be my father, it had to be my mother, and these people are like, they're like the nicest people you'd ever want to meet, you know. And my sisters and my parents have always had these great relationships, and I couldn't understand why I just couldn't connect with them, and I couldn't connect with other people, and but it was never my fault, right? So I don't know, you know, like I think my childhood to me was normal, and even like I did really well in school. I was a pretty good athlete. And I had a lot of friends, and I was really confident, maybe a little too much. And it's kind of weird, because, like, when I started getting sucked into my own head, which I'll talk about in a minute, it was like such a stark contrast to the way that I grew up. And I was always really outgoing and just never experienced even a moment of anxiety until in my 20s, or right before my 20s. But I started getting in trouble when I was like 12 or 13. I went from being like a really good kid, never cursed, never did anything wrong, nothing like that. And almost overnight, I was running around with guys in the neighborhood and doing vandalism and smoking cigarettes and that kind of stuff. And really, in hindsight, I like the reputation that that gave me. And I like being the center of attention, even if it meant getting in trouble or being perceived as, you know, somebody with that didn't care about consequences and that kind of thing. And it's just not even, like, I look at it now and it's not my personality, right? But for a long time it was, and it was this image, and it was this thing that I wanted to portray to you, and that I was cool and all this other stuff. And that was kind of my high school career. And like I used to joke for a while that I peaked in high school, and I don't even know if that's true, because you know, I was kind of a legend in my own mind, and you know how that goes. But you know, I outside issues are a part of my story, a big part. But I'll just say now, I'm definitely an alcoholic, and it's not because of all the drama of my drinking, which I always thought it was. It's really because I do suffer from the physical craving once it's in my body. I definitely suffered from the mental obsession, and I think I had like a triple dose of the spiritual malady. So I definitely qualify, and I qualify as an addict too. But with respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll do my best to leave that stuff out as much as I can. But with that being said, around 13, outside issues came into my life, and I was, you know, I was smoking some weed, and right away it became like I did it once, and I did it every day, and then I started drinking on the weekends, and I drank to blackout from the first time that I ever drank, and it wasn't this experience of like this epiphany where I came out of my skin and all of a sudden like everybody loved me and all this other stuff. It was just like I really enjoyed being drunk, like really drunk. And I really enjoyed doing stupid things, and I really enjoyed getting into trouble and chasing girls around and all that stuff. And I gravitated towards, like, I always had friends that when I look at it now, the friends that I drank with, a lot of them got in trouble, and, you know, and they're still kind of, some of them are still trying to find their way. Some of them went on and lived perfectly normal lives, healthy lives, which I never understood. But what I know now is they were hard drinkers. And when the time was right, they stopped or regulated. Like a lot of those guys still drink, but they were getting DUIs and they were getting in trouble. And so I kind of blended in with them. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But I always gravitated towards those kinds of people. And what became, it was a weekend thing. And also looking back, I realized that I always thought that I chose to go out and drink to blackout every time I drank. And I wore it like a badge of honor. And when I finally, after a long struggle in and out of AA, sat down with a guy that told me about the physical craving, there was a huge amount of guilt that I was relieved from, knowing that I really didn't have that choice. It's like this physical allergy hits, and it seems like I'm making a conscious decision to drink to blackout every time I'm drinking, you know, because I'm the one that's deciding, like, I'm going to drink to blackout tonight, right? It makes sense that it's a conscious decision. But I didn't realize that it's just because once I put that stuff in my system from the get-go, I drank to blackout. And that was important for me to know. It was important for me to start qualifying myself as the type of alcoholic that needed to have a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. It was important for me to know that, like, yes, this is my experience, and it always has been. And it wasn't a choice. Maybe in the beginning, maybe. For me, I don't think so. I think I was, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, that whole thing. I was an alcoholic right from the start. I just loved getting drunk and getting messed up. And so I did that regularly with minimal consequences. And like I graduated high school, somehow I had decent grades. I got into a college, and I went to senior week. I guess that was in like 1994. I'm dating myself. But 1994, and I don't remember much of senior week. I don't remember much of a lot of my story. Thank God or not thank God for fifth steps. I don't know if those of you have had the experience of sitting down with a guy and it's like, yeah, I did that. And it kind of comes back that way. But I was at senior week, and it was after a week of doing all kinds of drugs and drinking 24/7. And I was sitting on a couch the last day there, sober with a bunch of friends. And it was like, something was just totally different about this day. And this is sober. It was like I was sucked into my mind. Like my awareness of how the world was all of a sudden was drastically different from any way it had ever been before. And it's been my experience then, and it's been my experience in sobriety. I have these like really sharp shifts in the way that I see the world, like from an instant, like something's different, like immediately. And this started happening in reverse. Like I got sucked into this place where I was looking around and I got extremely nervous. And it was kind of like, what are these people looking at? You know, and like I couldn't quite talk to people, and I got really nervous, and I went for a long walk, and I thought like my heart started beating, and I was like, this is crazy. I hope that after a couple of days rest, maybe it's just too much partying over the week, that this will stop. And I was waiting for that thing to stop for years. For years, I became obsessed with what's wrong with me, and this is sober. And what changed was my drinking wasn't strictly for fun anymore. It was a release from that place that I actually lived in now, 24/7. And I don't know what anybody else's experience is, but my experience is that this was the most horrifying, most painful, most isolating place that I know ever. And I've been to jails and mental institutions and all these physical things, and they're nothing. Like, I would rather do a lifetime in jail to go back to living inside of that prison inside of myself. And so from that point on, I did whatever I could to get out of that place in my head. It was so uncomfortable. And the only thing that relieved that, even for a little bit, was alcohol. And I didn't know that I was spiraling downwards with alcoholism. I thought I was slowly losing my mind. I was ashamed of it. It was like embarrassing for me. So I would try to portray something, and it always took me, I had to drink just to like meet a friend for lunch. I had to have a little drink before I left. And when I was in college, I kind of, I could mix in because I could party on the weekends with everybody and then just suffer during the week. Like, I would walk around after everybody went home on my way back to my apartment, and I would just start bawling. You know, I would find somewhere and I would just start bawling, like in an alley, like what's going on with me? Like, what's happening to me? Like, I'm losing my mind here. And I'd pull it together, and the next day, you know, try to mix in with people and talk to my friends, and not telling anybody that, like, I'm dying on the inside and I have no idea what's going on. And I did that for a while until I took a break from college, and I came home, and I kind of told my parents what was going on. And that just started like a 10-year history with all different kinds of medication and psychiatrists. And I remember one guy, I went with my mom, and she would co-sign my BS for so long. Like, when she finally turned on me, I knew I was done. Like, because I remember going to this doctor's office, and she saw the way that I drank, and she saw the way that I lived. I mean, it was obvious, like, there's something wrong, you know, probably to everybody but me. I mean, I knew there was something wrong, but there was no way I was going to let go of the one thing that would let me out of this mental and emotional prison. And I remember going to this one doctor, and he was kind of asking me some questions, and I was really there just to get a script. I was trying to, you know, convince him to give me something for anxiety, Xanax or something. I don't even remember, whatever. And he said to me, "Do you drink?" And I was like, you know, occasionally, socially, on the weekends. And he says, "Well," I had a tattoo of an American Indian guy on a horse on my arm. He says, "What's your nationality?" And I was like, "What's this? What's my nationality? I'm American Indian, you know, a little bit of Irish." And he's like, "Well, you know, there's a long history of alcoholism in the America." And I was like, I looked at my mom like, "How dare this guy, racist?" You know, he's trying to tell me because I'm American Indian that like I'm an alcoholic. Like, this is crap. And she's like, "We're out of here. You know, we're leaving." So, it was just like that. And I don't want to look at any of that shit. And there's just no way I wasn't going to stop. Like, I wasn't going to stop. And it got to the point where I honestly, I was thinking about this on the drive up. because alcohol saved me from a lot of things. You know what I mean? Like, it caused a lot of damage in my life and probably caused the very things, I don't know, but it seemed to have caused a lot of the things that I was running from, but it also helped them. But all I know is the state of mind that I was in, no medication ever helped that state of mind. In any period of sobriety that I had, I tried every medication on the market. None of it ever even came close to touching the things that were going on inside of me. I saw a lot of great doctors, talked to a lot of great psychiatrists. Nothing, not even close. Like, they could, it just, I didn't know what was going on with me. Right? So alcohol, I was suicidal. Like, I thought about suicide constantly. How am I going to get through another day, let alone think about a future? The future was completely wiped out of my system at the age of 18. It's like this black wall just came down and I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see anything except, how do I not feel like this? I became obsessed with the way that I felt. And alcohol made me feel okay. It like got me to the next day and to the next day and to the next day, where I hoped that like somehow something would happen. If I get emotional, which I probably will, it just happens. You know, it is what it is. But it was just painful. All I knew was pain. It was so painful. And I was thinking about that on the way up here. Like, I have to be aware of what alcohol did for me as much as I'm aware of what it did to me. Because if I slip and I let go and I stop working this program, maybe I'll drink again. Hopefully I'll drink again, is what I'll say. Because I'll hang it up or drink again, one or the other. I'm not going back to that, right? My life just completely, like in a dramatic way, dissolved. I dropped out of college. I moved in with a girl in Philadelphia. And I started getting involved with outside issues along with alcohol. And I was doing things that it's like a dream, you know, or a nightmare. I can't believe that the about 8-year stretch that I went through with where alcohol and these substances took me. But at the same time, I get it, because I couldn't live at this point in time. I guess I was about 24. I couldn't step out of the house without something in my system. I couldn't even come out of my room to talk to a family member without something in my system. It's like if they looked at me, I would just fall to pieces right there. And so I'm living with that thing going on inside of me for 24/7. And I'm chasing everything, and I got to be drunk or high 24/7 because I can't live in my head. I just can't. My head's screaming at me. Right? I would go to bed on the nights that I didn't pass out or black out. I would go to bed, and I don't know how long I would sit there with this mantra or this reel of thinking of what a piece of crap I was. And I would come to, like, you know, after about an hour, and every muscle in my body would be clenched. And I don't know how I made it through that, honestly, besides the substances. But there started to be a string of rehabs. You know, like, my family found out finally. I had been in the hospital as a result of my using and drinking, and I was drinking in the hospital while I'm in there for drinking, and still trying to hide it all. And they just were like, "You're going to rehab. Like, from here, you're going to rehab." And I was like, "I'll go to a detox, but I'll quit using the drugs, but I'm not going to stop drinking." And they were like, "Fine. Just go to rehab, you know." And I went to my first rehab, and I had no desire to be there, no desire to stop drinking. Drinking was like really, it was a lot more subtle than the drugs. The drugs I could see, like, oh, this is a problem. You know, I'm doing things with these drugs and it's really causing trouble in my life. But drinking, that's okay. Like, I can do that. And my drinking after that rehab, I got out. I was there for like 5 days. I detoxed from the other substances. And I just kept drinking. And my drinking got to the point where it was 24/7. And I was drinking around the clock. And I was drinking to blackout. And I was waking up and drinking in the middle of the night. And I did that. And that started a string of in and out of rehabs and detoxes, a little bit of AA here and there, a recovery house maybe here and there. And I think I stayed sober one time for like 16 days. And I don't even know, like thinking about it now, like that was a miracle. I don't know how I walked around with the head that I had and the way that I felt for 16 days. I probably hid in my bedroom for about 16 days. It's probably more or less what it was, and like ran to a meeting here and there. And then it just got so bad. I remember one night I came home in a blackout. I don't remember it. I kind of remember the consequences. And something happened. I got into some kind of fight with my dad, and my mom jumped in. And the next morning they woke me up and they said, we're going out for however long. And when we get back, you're not allowed near this home. If we see you, we're going to call the cops. That's it. Done. And I knew they meant it this time. I just knew it. And I felt so horrible for coming after my dad physically, you know, because at this point in time, he's older, and I was so unpredictable and crazy. And, you know, that's an amends that I continue to try to make, is for coming after him physically. I feel horrible about it. But so I woke up the next morning, and I was like, this is the day that I'm ending it. I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And the only reason I know that that day, obviously it didn't work, but the only reason I know it was going to happen is I felt this peace come over me that I had really like longed for. It was like a surrender to the idea of suicide, right? And it was like, I knew, I was like, this is it. Like, thank God. The fight's over. And so I stole a car and some money. I don't want to go out without causing a scene. Stole a car and some money, and I got some booze, started drinking. And I was, my plan was to go overdose on something. And so it wouldn't, you know, I didn't want to hurt. I'd like to go out feeling good. So that was my plan. And so I'm drinking and I'm driving. It was like 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And I got lost a few miles from my house. I don't know what I was doing. And I was just like flying around on these back roads drunk and trying to figure out how to get back onto the road I needed to get onto. And came over a hill and there was a cop there, like standing in the road talking to a neighbor. And he's like, well, you know, he's waving me down. And I pull over for some strange reason. I pulled over and I didn't have a license. So I don't even know. Like the guy comes up to the door and he's like, you know, let me see your license. And I handed him this walking ID. And he walked back to his car, and I just took off. And I don't even know. It's like a real hazy recollection, but I know I looked in my rearview mirror, and it was like OJ. There was this four-wheel drive police cruiser and like five other cars, and they're following me down the road, and I'm going like 90 down these back roads, and I don't know what happened. The car shot off the road. It flipped like 7 times, front over end, and I came to with the jaws of life pulling me out. I was tucked. I wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and I was tucked under the dashboard of the car on the passenger side. They pulled me out, and this isn't for dramatics. This is really true. I saw the bottle come out right after they pulled me out, and it was empty. And then, like, the only thing I thought was like, you know, like there's no more booze left. Like, what am I going to do? And so I went to the hospital, and the cop comes to the hospital, and he didn't know I was on this suicide mission that day. He had no idea. He didn't. He really, all he said was, either you check yourself into a mental institution or you're getting 302'd, because that was a suicide attempt. And I don't remember, like, it probably was. But he said, you know, since the car was going straight and it just veered off the road at, 90 miles an hour, that he was convinced it was a suicide attempt. So I went to this awesome place in Norristown. It's Building 50. Anybody ever been there? It's nice. It's really nice. And I was there. When I got there, I was like, what the? Where the hell am I? Like, this is nuts. Like, I'm not one of these people. There's people shuffling around in their hospital gowns and, like, doing the Thorazine shuffle and drooling on themselves, and they've got arts and crafts and all this other stuff. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, what did I do? And I'm supposed to be there for 3 days, but I told them that I got hurt in the car accident. They didn't know I was a drug addict and alcoholic, so they started giving me pain medication. And then I convinced my my roommate to give me his medication. And so I strapped on a gown, and I got into arts and crafts. And I stayed there for they finally found – I was telling them all this crazy stuff, like I see blood and like I want to kill and and I really, this is the insanity of my disease, because I was getting what I needed. All I ever needed was something to fill that space, right? It's all, like, if that could happen in my life some way without using drugs and alcohol, like, sign me up. That's all I need. I don't care where I work. I don't care. I don't know, like, I could do the most boring and mundane task if I'm filled up in that spot. And I'm good. Like, I don't know why later on when I came to sobriety, it was like, maybe the steps, but I need money and a car and all this other crap. I mean, that stuff never worked. Nothing ever worked. But I stayed in that place for a couple, I guess it was a month and a half. And I could have been out after 3 days, but I was having a good time. Then I went to jail for that incident with the cop. It was my third DUI and a bunch of other charges, and I was in jail for a year. And you would think that's the end of the story, but it wasn't. I was getting drunk. I was just talking to Rich outside. We were taking hand sanitizer and draining it through socks and drinking in jail there, and. And I was getting high in jail, and in the first 6 months, that was what I did, just to pass the time. And it wasn't like every day, but I was doing it. But in the second 6 months, I really saw, again, for the second time, very clearly that drugs were my problem. I'm going to quit the drugs again. But drinking, I could probably still do. Like, that I'm not ready to let go of. And so... I came out of that situation, and let's just say, like, the drinking didn't work out, and I'd like to speed this up and get into some of the recovery. So I ended up in AA after a number of rehabs again. I ended up in AA somehow, some way, I think. So I came to AA, and I was in AA for 4.5 years. I stayed somewhat sober, let's say. Because I was also seeing, I had like a team of psychiatrists and psychologists that I was seeing, and I was getting the right combination of meds to deal with my insanity, And then I would come to meetings and sit in the back, a lot of meetings, to deal with my drinking problem. So like AA, what I thought AA is for your drinking. And you come here and you come to meetings and you won't want to drink. And that's kind of the message that I heard. And when I finally sat down with a guy years later and got the message out of the big book, I had a resentment against. I think everybody goes through a crusade phase where it's like, you know, you're beating people over the head with the big book. And but I look back on it now. In that stretch of time, I probably did hear a message like this, but it wasn't my time. You know, I believe I heard it when I heard it for this, you know, I mean, I have to believe that. And thank God I did. I mean, I'm not complaining now. But at first I was a little resentful because I was going to meetings in an area where it's just a lot of topic meetings and also a lot of don't drink and come to meetings and some really well-meaning people. And I met a lot of good people. But like that state of mind that I was in, that I drank and used drugs over for so long, that painful state of mind was still there. It was dulled down just a little bit. Like it was kind of, AA helped me to feel a little bit better. Okay, now I'm not drinking. And life started to sort of come together a little bit. But I could only sit in the back of the room. And the sponsor that I had, I like really loved this guy, genuinely. He was not a big steps guy. He was not a big book guy. But he helped a lot of people. And he was all about service. It's just that with me, I couldn't look people in the eyes. I couldn't talk to people. I would sit in the back of a meeting and maybe once every 3 months, I would raise my hand and I would have to hyperventilate for like 10 seconds before I could like utter out like, I'm full of anxiety. Thanks for letting me share. My name's Ben. And that's about the extent of my sharing. But it was like, and people would be, oh, good share, appreciate your honesty. Keep coming back, wait for the miracle. And I'm like, that's what I'm doing. Waiting for this miracle, but it's not happening. And I didn't know that while you're waiting for the miracle, you should probably get your feet moving and do some things. And it really wasn't stressed. I remember my sponsor now, was coming up from a group in Philadelphia, and he came to Doylestown. He's like, what's up with Doylestown AA? I was like, what? You know, it's great. And he's like, well, I just came from a group where they had you doing the steps and like, you know, the first 30 days and da, 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 da. And he didn't stay sober down there. He like left AA and ended up drinking again. He came up to Doylestown. He's like, ah, yeah, this is much better. Like just relax and take it easy. No, like grinding through the steps and doing all that other stuff. And he couldn't stay sober. And I really couldn't stay sober. And, we would kind of like talk about what do you think it is? Because every once in a while we would see somebody who looked like they had something that we wanted. And it would be like, we know there's something here. And we would have these like long philosophical debates about what it is. And it had nothing to do with the steps at all. Like it just wasn't, I never even heard the term spiritual malady. I never heard that selfish and self-centeredness was the root of my problem. Like these are important things for me to know. And I just didn't hear them. I don't. And so it came to a point where I was so insane, sober again, and my life was falling apart. And I remember I started to get into like collecting sneakers. And I think it was like 543 pairs later. And I was in debt up to my eyeballs. And I couldn't stop buying sneakers. I mean, it's not like I don't want to brag about it. It's not something I'm proud of. It's just I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know. I just wanted to fill this hole with anything, whether it was money, whether it was relationships. I got into a couple of relationships early on in that sobriety. And like I had no business being in a relationship with another human being. I was completely insane. And you know, when they would break up with me, it was like the most horrible experience ever, because now I'm left with me. And, you know, and it was just a mess. And I was fighting with my family constantly. I was getting in trouble at work all the time. The only reason I didn't get fired is I was friends with my boss. And it became really clear to me that I'm much older now and much wiser, and that this AA thing isn't really working. I'm probably not an alcoholic. I probably just went through some growing pains, you know, back when all that stuff happened. And this, my mind slowly convinced me that this was probably true. And really on the flip side of that, it's, I was starting to get suicidal again. So I had like in my mind two options, and I was going to meetings and I was doing what I was told to do, and I was raising my hand and I was sharing about it, and people were giving me good suggestions. Well, they weren't really that good, but they were trying to help. And I drank again, and immediately, like the first night I drank, I got arrested. I got into a fight, and I got arrested, and I tried to drive, and I tried to successfully drink for another year, and I came back into AA, and I stayed sober another year, same amount of pain. And I remember my mom at one point was like, "I feel like I'm raising somebody with special needs." And she was right, because I was a mess. Like, I was just a mess. And I would snap out and I would lash out, and I had so much anger and I had so much depression and I had so much sadness, and I couldn't verbalize it. And I no longer had the alcohol or the drugs to blame for what was going on with me. And I've tried every diet. I just had nothing. There was nothing left. And I started to think, maybe she's right. Maybe I have something. Like, maybe I am a special needs kid. I don't know. And I met a guy. I didn't meet him. The guy that was my friend that came to Doylestown A from Philadelphia, he ended up meeting up with a guy. He moved a little bit out of our area, and he met up with a guy that took him through the steps in like a two-day period. And he came and he talked to me, and he was like, "Hey, would you want to sit down and go through this step work? Like, I just went through in 2 days." And this is like AA blasphemy. You do not go through the steps in 2 days. You go through the steps in like 4 years. And if you do go through the steps that fast, you're going to relapse. Like, this is what I was told. And that's what I believed. And he's like, "Look." And I could see in him something had changed, because I knew the guy. And we sat down at his kitchen table. It's just a classic AA story. Like, we sat down at his kitchen table, and we went through the doctor's opinion, which I probably read maybe 10 times before on my own, and I just didn't understand it. I don't know why, but that book on my own didn't make any sense to me and was like really horrible reading. And when I sat down with this guy, right, with just the right amount of willingness, because I'll tell you, when he started talking in a way that I hadn't heard before, and this program started to become something that I hadn't heard before, I was salivating for something. Like some glimmer of hope. So I started to have an experience like right away, because I just knew something inside of me knew this was different. And this is what I needed, right? And I had so much willingness. Like, that pain is not that far behind me today. I can feel it back here, right? It drives me. Like, it just drives me. I'm not going back there. But this was the first time all these doctors, the drugs and the alcohol had stopped working. I knew that place they talk about in the big book when the drink doesn't work anymore and you can't stop and you can't live with it or without it, however it says. I'm not a good quoter. But I know that loneliness. So when he started talking this way, I don't know. Like, to be quite honest, I didn't expect what ended up happening. I thought maybe like over some time, this could be what I needed. And so we went through, we started talking about the physical allergy, started talking about the mental obsession and mental blank spots. And I'm using my experience to answer these questions. Like, is this my experience? Because if I go to my head, it's like, well, there was that one time when I went to the prom when I was 18, I didn't drink, so maybe I don't have the... But I used my experience, and it was like, you know, I was definitely suffering from the craving. and the allergy. I was definitely suffering from the mental blank spots, and I was definitely suffering from the spiritual malady and the unmanageability of life. And he pointed me to page 52, which, like, you know, I was like, that's me, you know, full of fear and anxiety, of no real use to anybody, full of, you know, remorse and guilt and shame and all this stuff. I knew it was me. And so what he said was, and he went right from the doctor's opinion, is that, like, if this is you, the only thing that's ever worked that they have to suggest is a spiritual experience. And that's what these steps are about. See, I didn't even know what the steps were for. I thought it was like a better model for living. And it just seemed kind of corny. And plus, God was plastered all over it. And I wasn't into the God thing. But when he explained it to me, like, this is the disease that you have. You're going to die. It's never, because I was like, even through this period of time, like, my whole life was spent waiting for this thing. Just one day it's going to make sense. One day it's all going to make sense. And it didn't. And he said, like, you have to take these actions to bring about this change in your life. And to get, he started talking about powerlessness and lack of power is my dilemma. And it just all made sense. And we did this fourth step. And this is kind of like where things really came into light. And he talked about selfishness and self-centeredness. And at first I was like, hold on, you know, I'm a really nice guy. I'm shy and I don't really hurt anybody, especially now that I'm sober. So I don't really think I'm selfish and self-centered, maybe way back when I was drinking and stuff like that. And he's like, well, all right. I was like, I don't even like myself. And he's like, all right, well, how much or how often do you think about how much you don't like yourself or how much other people don't like you? Or, you know, and when he said that, I was like, oh my God, that's nonstop. All I think about is how I feel, how you feel about me, how a certain look might mean something. And then I have this dialect between you and me, and I'm going to show you, and this whole thing. And that's all I ever thought about. And then he showed me a pattern. The first inventory I ever did was this, like, checklist inventory. And we just kind of went through, and I saw a pattern of thinking and a pattern of behaving. And these things called character defects, self-centered character defects, based in resentment and fear and self-centeredness and dishonesty and laziness and pride. And it's like based off the seven deadly sins. But he had this checklist, and we went through. And it's not like the skies parted or anything, but I saw that I wasn't like, I really thought it would take a team of doctors to fix what was so horribly wrong with me. But for the first time, I saw, like, I'm an alcoholic. Like, it was the first time I really could say, like, I'm an alcoholic, and I can see what that means. I have this disease, and I have this self-centeredness. And it's been a pattern for me throughout my whole entire life. And for the first time, it just became like, oh my God, like, this is really it. Like, this is really what's been going on with me for all this time. And I remember, so we did that, a fourth and fifth step right at his table. And then we talked about six and seven, and about letting go of these things, becoming willing to let go of these things, and really about becoming willing to let go of my life. It's kind of like the third step prayer with teeth, I heard one time. And it's like, now that you see what's going on with you, are you willing to believe that there's a power greater than you that will take these things from you, that will restore you to some level of sanity, that will put peace back in your life, that will make use of you? And, like, I saw it. I just saw, like, if I can just let go and trust that something can happen here, like, please take it. Please take it. Please take all of me. I had an experience. We went through that process. And a few days later, I was sitting at one of the normal meetings that I go to, and I had this experience of, like, I felt like I was physically, like, high. It was weird. And I was present, and I was looking around, and it was just like me and you and nothing going on in my head. My heart wasn't racing. And I was like, what's this? This is crazy. You know what I mean? Like, I lived in sheer terror of people. And I called my grand sponsor, and I was like, I was at a meeting, and I had this feeling come over me, and I didn't take anything, and I don't know what's going on. And he just started laughing. He's like, that's the spiritual experience you're supposed to have as a result of doing this work. There honestly is not a day that goes by to this day, that was 2 years ago, that I don't think at least once how incredible this is. Like, I didn't know any of this stuff, right? I didn't know you could feel good like this. And it's not like it always feels good. So that catapulted me into making amends, and I had some extremely great experiences with amends, and really, like, at this point, felt God completely saturate, like, my entire being. After one of my harder amends, I pulled over on the side of the road, and I was just flooded with this experience of God. You know, at this point in time, I was like, this is God. I mean, it's so overwhelming. Like, every fiber of my being was lit up from the inside out, and that catapulted me into wanting to take this message to other people. But I got deep into meditation and prayer. And that's been a saving grace on top of helping people and sponsoring people and taking meetings into jails and that kind of stuff. And this isn't for me to say or to brag or anything. It's just that God's making use of me. Right. I just when I really saw what the third step prayer meant, I really got catapulted into this thing of listening. I was just like a madman listening to every possible big book breakdown on recording that I could listen to. And I really fell like in love with this like Joe Hawk and Mark Houston tapes. And they explained things at a deeper level. And so it was like a couple weeks later after I started feeling all these experiences that I had like an even deeper third step experience. And I got on the corner on my knees at work, like in front of a lot of people. I was like, take me. Take all of me. Take me and use me. I don't want anything. I want nothing. I don't want anything. Please take me. And I was begging God in this third step experience. And it's just powerful. And I still have that willingness every single day. My life hasn't changed that much. I don't expect much. I don't expect anything other than to be provided for, to be of service to you guys and to sponsees, and a deeper relationship with God. I've had some wild experiences, like spiritual experiences, and I don't think there's a limit to what we can experience on a personal level through self-sacrifice and service to others and a daily meditation and inventory process. Like, I really know that there's so much more I could let go of and give to God. You know, my ego's going to hang out. And my process now is really getting further into 6 and 7 and seeing those underlying defects that I can't let go of no matter how hard I try, and that I try not to beat myself up if they don't change or they don't look the way I want them to. Because sometimes it's God, I've got to go through periods of pain, but it's different pain. It's pain with like this constant source of inspiration. And this, it's with me. I feel it wherever I go, in pain, in pleasure. And like, I just love trying to give that to somebody else. And when somebody gets it, for those of you that have had the opportunity and the good fortune to sponsor somebody that's gone on and like maybe calls you and says like, hey, I'm sitting down with a guy, you know, that's like the most amazing thing in the world, because you know what they're embarking on. And for any drug addict and alcoholic to get filled up in that same way, like when drugs and alcohol used to work in the very beginning, but it doesn't hurt anybody and it doesn't cost anything and people's lives improve and you can feel good about yourself. You can rest your head on the pillow at night and you can wake up and do it all over again. What else is there, really, for me? Thanks a lot.
Whew. The group would like to thank Ben again for coming up and sharing this story with us. The group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise your hand? Thank you. And Rich has something to share with the group this time. Rich?
Rich, I'm an alcoholic. Had to get the tears off my eyes. Thank you, Ben. Hanging around this fellowship long enough, man, you get to see some really awesome stuff. You got me going, dude. I met this young lady right at the beginning of her journey, and it's just been absolutely incredible, and I'm not going to take up any of your time. I just want to have everyone help me recognize one of our home group members who 5 years ago on the 7th of February came to us. It's now celebrated 5 years, Lauren.
Wow. How you guys doing? I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
This is sort of unbeknownst to me that somebody was going to get me a coin and say that stuff. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rich. Which is good because I didn't have a lot of time to think about what I was going to say, right? I'd be thinking about it. Thank you for your story. Thank you for your story. And it's kind of really, it's like when Ben was talking about like the spiritual experience, like I related to that, you know, like the spiritual experience. I think that I can remember having the same thing. It's like I'm driving home from my sponsor's house after I do this fifth step, and it's like I felt like the car's wheels weren't touching the ground. Like I can't even really describe it. The way that Ben said it was much more eloquent, but it was the same experience. And I can remember thinking after that, like this actually might be possible to do. Like this might actually like work for like a long time instead of just like how long can I hold on until it gets all messed up again. And it's really cool. Like I got to like when I actually the day that I actually had, I can remember like working with a sponsor in the beginning and she had like 5 or 6 years and I'm like, oh my God, like that seems like incredibly unattainable. Like that seems like totally, but I spoke on my 5-year anniversary and it was like this really like beautiful, like magical thing. It was like my mom was at the meeting that I was speaking at and my dear friend Sandy was at the meeting, two incredibly instrumental women in my life and my recovery. And it was just, I was crying, my mom was crying. It was just like really amazing, you know? So anyway, I think that that's all I got, but thank you. Thank you, Rich.
Ooh, it's just a rock stellar night tonight. It's just a stellar night. Thank you all for coming out. We also have another coin that we get to give out tonight, and that's, you know, a spiritual experience. I thought drugs and drugs and alcohol were a high. And man, what, talk about selling yourself short. That is nothing like watching those around you recover. Watching families get reunited, watching people get clear and clean, watching their eyes light up and they come back to life, and then watching them pass it on to others. It's just such a miraculous program. And how God can take a bunch of people who, for me anyway, that abused everything that God ever put in my path and somehow use that to help other people. It's just phenomenal. This young woman is one of our home group members as well. That's where we give out coins is to our home group. And she walked in here, and I still remember the night she walked in. I had, you know, no matter how long I'm in this program, I can't ever look at people and go, yeah, that one's going to recover. I'm always way wrong, way wrong. But every day has been a joy. And I love the people that get to come in and find out that if you come in here and you do those steps and you take those actions and not just read and study them, you get to recover from a spiritual, from a mental, spiritual, and physical malady. And she has done the work, which is why she has gotten the results. Jenny, would you come up and get your year coin?
Well, I'm kind of glad Lauren went first. I did have an idea what to say, but I have no idea what to say now. I do like to thank Ben, though. I totally relate it with that pain that you mentioned. That was my entire life. But this past year, I think I've lived life more than I have in all my 40 years. Today, I stand here free from the obsession to drink, obsession of self, and I had nothing to do with it. It's through the grace of God, through Alcoholics Anonymous, these amazing steps, and all of you, that I am sober today. And if I can share one quick story with you. I found you on the internet. It was last winter, in the middle of a snowstorm. There was like 9 inches of the snow on the ground. And in one of my last acts of desperation, I searched in AA meetings and clicked on the word search. And there you were. And my loving husband, who was as desperate as I was, drove me here. And that night when I walked through those double doors led to a series of events that put me on the most powerful journey of my life. And that night when I was here, there was a woman celebrating her 7-year anniversary. And she came up here, she said a few things, and when she sat down, she put her coin in my hand. And when I looked at it, it gave me a little bit of hope. And that hope, folks, changed everything. It kept me coming back. And now I stand here, which is awesome. And the point of that story I wanted to share with you is that those newcomers that come through the door, the simplest little thing that we can do for them makes the all the difference in the world, because it did for me. It was through this fellowship, particularly this home group, that I found my sponsor. And God couldn't have chosen a more perfect person to put in my life. It's amazing the profound effect that one person's simple, selfless act of love and kindness can have on another person's life. It saved my life. And that's sponsorship. And that's what makes this program work. Words cannot express the love and appreciation I have for her. If there's one, well, within these rooms, I have found true friendship. And a power that exists among us that truly saves the lives of those sick and suffering from this unforgiving disease. And the coolest thing I've learned this past year is that what seems to be impossible can become a reality if you're just willing to give it a try. So if you're out there and you're new and you're feeling as hopeless as I did a year ago, or if you've been around for a while and you're still suffering inside, take a look around because there's miracles all over this room. Reach out and ask for help and you can become one of those miracles too. Thank you all for helping me stay sober this past year.